Greetings. Happy Thursday. Welcome to the Steve Day Show here, live and on demand on Blaze TV radio and podcast. Today is a very, very big day, and I'll tell you why here after I tell you about our friends over at First Cup Coffee Company, the Patriot-owned coffee company with a flavor for every freedom-loving American. If you want to join up today, get 10% off when you do at firstcup.com using the promo code DACE. That's firstcup.com, promo code DACE to get 10% off. They put the roast date right there on every bag. They ship it out to you days within being roasted so that you get the freshest brew and blend that you want. And if you subscribe, you'll get an extra 10% off for the life of your subscription as well at firstcup.com. Use the promo code DACE. That's firstcup.com. Use the promo code DACE. So I mentioned today is a very big day. All right. I'm trying to figure out which one I should start with. Let's start with Aaron and why you are sitting here. And you look, wow, that's an enthusiasm unknown to mankind. I mean, you're literally just coming out of your skin there. That's Todd. Can you feel the energy? Are you feeling that vibe?
Can you feel the love tonight?
I can. Yeah, indeed. So we are doing something that's never happened in the history of this program, at least since Aaron came to work here. Someone other than Aaron is producing it. It's never happened before. All right. So our former intern, Victoria, because your paternity leave is imminent.
Yeah.
All right.
Last night I was like, I might need to text these guys, but we're good now.
We're good now. Okay. Yeah. So our former intern, Victoria, somehow after spending a summer with us, decided she wanted to come back even for a limited engagement, which shocked us as much as anybody else, frankly. She is over there now. Minding the controls. This is your baby. You just gave the keys to the car away for the very first time. How are you feeling right now, Mr. McIntyre?
You know, I'm more nervous about sitting here, actually, than I was the last few days that she's actually... I've been shadowing her the last couple of days. What are we doing here?
Nervous.
No, I'm not. Well, I'm nervous being right here because I've got to sit next to you guys. The last couple of days, I've had no nerves whatsoever because I haven't had to do anything. She's been doing all the work. Now... You remember that overtime that I did where I poked fun at you and Todd?
Yes. Very popular overtime, in fact.
Yeah. I've been here a grand total of 5 minutes. I've had headpiece issues, which is why I'm wearing these headphones right now. Okay, the struggle is real. I got one in, but it was my right ear, and I realized that it was showing, a la Todd. Okay, my tendency is to look at the monitor right there, a la Todd. I don't know what to do with my hands, a la you, that's why you were constantly fiddling with the microphone. I'm having some regrets about what I did in that overtime now. It was still a good overtime, though.
Indeed. So, Victoria has been communicated. We have one rule around here.
Yeah.
Just don't suck.
Yeah.
I mean, that's our one rule. I mean, if you can avoid just in a panic, dipping and quitting in the middle, you know. If when in doubt, just start pushing indiscriminate buttons, and eventually we'll get to the right one.
Yep, it's true.
So just don't suck, all right? So that's the one rule for you now, sitting here at the big boy table for the first time.
Oh, was I supposed to say something to that?
Exactly. All right, the other big reason today is a big day, and you know it's a big day. The wife went on Walmart.com and got me a brand new Wrangler shirt that I'm wearing right now so that I'm wearing my Sunday best, baby. All right? Because today, what?
This is your Sunday best.
That's a true story, by the way. That's not even an embellishment.
I was thinking about yesterday. Is it slate or obsidian black?
Yes.
Is that where we're headed?
Yes.
Is this a metaphor?
Well, we're doing a book that has done that to many people over the centuries. In fact, we are starting next hour a brand new series on Theology Thursday. For only the second time, we're going to do a study of an actual book of the Bible. We're going to go all the way through it. Now, today is going to be kind of an introduction. A lot of you have asked me, hey, what Spurgeon work am I using? I'll just show it, and I'll show it again next hour. It's this one. Spurgeon's Verse Exposition of Romans is the one that I will be using on my side of the fence. Todd, what do you have over there on yours?
Scott Hahn's Romans.
And Scott Hahn is an interesting character in particular because why?
formerly of your
tribe? He used
tribe?
To be an evangelical.
Now
yeah,
of my
he's now
tribe.
A Catholic, yeah. So Spurgeon's Verse Exposition of Romans is what we'll, where we'll be going for the correct answers. And then for an alternative take, we'll find out, I guess, if there's time, what Scott Hahn thinks. Fair?
Aaron, we're going to be doing this for months, ladies
right.
and gentlemen.
It's going to be a long ride, kids.
I'm using the God Bless America.
Yes.
Trump-endorsed King James Version, the version that Paul used, mind you. That's what I'm going to be using.
You guys are not going to let that go, man. You guys are not, okay?
Proudly.
So today will be an introduction into the book of Romans. When was it written? To whom was it written to? What's the cultural backdrop? And then next week, we'll actually begin to dig into the actual text. So we'll start that this week on Theology Thursday. That's coming up next hour. After Theology Thursday, we're going to be joined by my good friend, Dr. Jeremiah Johnston, looking ahead to, of course, this weekend, the culmination of Holy Week and evidence for the resurrection. That's kind of what he does over at Prestonwood Baptist. He's their pastor of apologetics. He's in the C.S. Lewis Society. Pretty smart dude. He co-authored the Nefarious Bible Study with yours truly, and frankly, he wrote most of it. Okay, so we're going to pick his brain about evidences for the resurrection coming up at the end of the show. And then at the bottom of this hour, Brad Wilcox from The Marriage Project is a longtime friend of the program. He's got a new book out on the institution of marriage and its cultural impact. We'll talk to him about that coming up at the bottom of this hour. But before we get to all of that, here is Aaron's rundown of what happened while we were away.
What happened while we were away, brought to you by Revenge of the Killer Nerd. And revenge is a dish best served by winning. Just this week, actually just yesterday, in one day, a federal court ruled to uphold Florida's congressional district map, saying it doesn't discriminate on the basis of race, unlike what plaintiffs had claimed, and abides by the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Back in 2022, Florida legislature and Governor Ron DeSantis approved a redrawn map of Florida's legislative districts. You'll remember the original map drawn by the legislature was rejected and modified by DeSantis, and that's the one that passed. The redistricting in Florida was and is the majority Republicans have in the House of Representatives right now, thanks to the 2022 midterms. And that congressional map is staying in place. Also yesterday, DeSantis signed into law HB 621, which gives homeowners the right to call law enforcement to remove squatters from their homes. It also enforces penalties for those who encourage others to break the law by squatting. And finally, the Walt Disney Company's last gasp effort to maintain at least some of their special autonomous governing authority for an area outside of Orlando failed yesterday after a new settlement was reached between the state-appointed Central Florida Board and the company. Under the agreement, Disney is set to drop the lawsuit against the Central Florida Tourism Oversight District, and the district will drop its own lawsuit against Disney. DeSantis says he sees this as an opportunity for everyone involved to move on into a new era of prosperity.
I think that there's going to be ways where we can do things that are in the best interest of the state of Florida. And I think Disney can be a part of that. I mean, certainly you look at Universal, they're doing the Epic Universe. That's going to be a huge, huge game changer for this region. I got to think Disney would have an interest in maybe offering another one. The district will be ready to negotiate something to be able to be good for the state of Florida, be good for jobs, and be good for all those things.
Today, DeSantis announced,
we have now rescued over 100 Floridians from Haiti. You have a very difficult situation there, and it's our view that if the federal government's not stepping up to do the job that you would expect to rescue American citizens, then by golly, we're going to go in there and help our people.
Oh, and earlier this week, the governor signed a bill into law that bans minors under the age of 14 from creating social media accounts and requires minors above that age to obtain parental permission, seen by many as a win for protecting children from online threats. Headline from the Babylon Bee, DeSantis kicked out of the Republican Party for accomplishing too many things. Moving on, American conservative Union Chairman Matt Schlapp has agreed to a hefty settlement to bring an end to a sexual assault lawsuit filed by a former staffer for failed Georgia Senate candidate Herschel Walker. The staffer, who is a man named Carlton Huffman, accused Schlapp of making unwanted sexual advances on him, including groping and fondling his groin without consent on the ride back from two Atlanta-area bars on October 19th of 2022. According to the Daily Caller, the Biden administration is considering doling out green cards to illegals. The reported idea
would apply to illegals who have been in the country for more than 10 years and is one of many ideas the administration is reportedly considering to act as if they care about the border invasion. In Baltimore, of course, this week, they experienced the catastrophe of the destruction of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, which will cripple trade in and out of their seaport for months and cripple transit through the city for years. Naturally, Mayor Brandon Scott is worried about racism.
I know, and we all know, and you know very well, that black men and young black men in particular have been the boogeyman for those who are racist and think that only straight, wealthy white men should have a say in anything. We've been the boogeyman from them since the first day they brought us to this country. And what they mean by DEI, in my opinion, is duly elected incumbent. We know what they want to say, but they don't have the courage to say the N-word.
And finally, Joel Osteen.
Well, you say, Joel, are you one of those prosperity ministers? And while I don't like the term prosperity minister, I must say I am not a poverty minister. I can't find one place in the scripture where we are supposed to drag around not having enough, not able to afford what we want, living off the leftovers, living in the land of not enough. No, we were created to be the head and not the tail. Jesus came that we might live an abundant life. We represent Almighty God here on this earth. We should be examples of His goodness, so blessed, so prosperous, so generous, so full of joy that other people want what we have. But you've got to fight a religious spirit that says you're supposed to be poor, broke, and defeated to show God that you're really humble. No, when you're poor, broke, and defeated, all that proves is that you're poor, broke, and defeated. It doesn't bring any honor to God. If I brought my two children up on the platform today and their clothes were all raggedy, worn out, holes in their shoes, hair not combed, you would look at me and think, what kind of father is he? It'd be a poor reflection on me. Listen, when you look good, dress good, live in a nice place, excel in your career, generous with others, that brings a smile to God's face.
Learning Chinese today, today's phrase is, who are the ravenous wolves Jesus talked about?
耶稣所说的贪婪的狼是谁?
And that's what happened while we were away.
Aaron's Montage brought to you by our friends over at Jace Medical. Do you remember a time when vital medications didn't get rationed in the United States, when award-winning medications were not suddenly deemed dangerous with no evidence whatsoever? If you remember that time and you're wondering, what in the Sam Hill is happening now? Things just aren't that way anymore. And this is just one reason why you've got to have the Jace case on hand. It's a personalized emergency medication kit that contains five essential antibiotics. It's also customizable with dozens of add-on medications available as well. So you can choose the one that's best for you and your family's needs. And if you are looking after maybe an elderly loved one and you want to care for them and make sure they have what they need, you can do that with a gift box as well, or a gift case as well. And yes, they even have ivermectin as an add-in option. Get gift cards for those that you love. Just go to jacemedical.com and get that peace of mind you're looking for. That's J-A-S-E at jacemedical.com. Enter the code DACE at checkout for a discount on your order. That's promo code DACE, D-E-A-C-E, promo code DACE for a discount at jacemedical.com. Again, that is jacemedical.com. Let's go to Aaron's Montage. Gentlemen, I think maybe we have once and for all solved the mystery of why I've never been invited to speak at CPAC. Now, someone on X just said it could also be because you're pedantic and long-winded. Tough but fair. I mean, that's could also be a possibility. Although, if pedantic and long-winded got you instantly disqualified from being on the speaker circuit at CPAC, it would be a very limited engagement. Fair?
It's true.
It is true. Okay, so I think looking at the character of those who actually run this event these days, I think we've maybe answered that mystery. We've solved it once and for
Matt
all
Schlapp,
and can probably move on, maybe.
Matt Schlapp said he was vindicated through this, which is why he's paying that guy $480,000.
Yes, he said that in a tweet he deleted. Yeah, he said that in a tweet that he deleted after he paid him $500,000, so apparently, according to the report. So there is that. Let's talk about the DeSantis thing for a second. And, when I was there on Monday with him in Naples, we actually were talking about Universal's Epic Adventure because I mentioned it. I had watched a couple of videos on it, and I'm just, like, blown away by what they are building there, you know. And so he gave me some of the backstory and some of the stuff on that. And he was telling me just how much differently Universal handled COVID and reopening than Disney did when he was trying to save these parks, basically.
I remember going on our honeymoon back in 2021, and they were asking, we took an exit survey of Universal, and they were asking questions like, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you value personal liberty? It's like, what is a theme park doing asking questions about that? But that kind of goes to show you.
And if you and he was talking about how so much of what they do at Disney is dated. It's the same stuff they just had there year after year after year, or variations on a theme, etc. And so I know, for those of you that are wondering, okay, I don't understand. He just crushed them. I mean, just absolutely to the point of hearing the lamentations of their women. And now he's like, you know, extending them an invitation to do more. Help me understand that. I get it. I get it. You're on the American right. And so what you witness there is just, it's an occurrence that you're just not accustomed to. It's a moment that you've just not experienced a lot because you're on the American right. And so therefore, it almost seems foreign in a way. It's unsettling, kind of. It's called a victory lap. And unfortunately, to take said lap on the American right, we need what first?
Wins.
Yeah, you need victories first, right? The victory has to precede the victory lap, correct? And so we don't get a lot of those. This guy got three, like, we're not even talking Texas Leaguer singles yesterday. Three that all three were minimum power alley, went to the wall, stand-up doubles. Arguably, all three were home runs, okay? And the vast majority of Republicans in this country don't even try to get one in a term, let alone three happen in a day. And I got to tell you guys, you know what? I wasn't told no, so I'm going to share this. The governor and I sat backstage at First Baptist Church, just the two of us, one-on-one, for about 30 minutes before the event began, just talking and catching up on things, okay? How our families are doing, et cetera. I have to tell you, watching him interact with the constituents in Florida and just the way that he discusses political matters in his state. I will say this. I have been around a lot of politicians. A lot. A lot running for president. I've been around men who've gotten elected president. I've never seen anything like watching Ron DeSantis in his native element in the state of Florida. It's not Trumpian. I mean, he doesn't have kind of that celebrity aura where, hey, can I just get a picture with you? You know, I mean, Donald Trump's one of the biggest, you know, stars on planet Earth. And he was even before he became president. Okay, so it's not that. It's not like a celebrity kind of a thing. And it's not like what you typically see with politicians where people are anxious, where he's receiving of their slurping. He's just not a guy that is, you know, down with that. That won't work on him on any level. Just does not care about that kind of stuff. So it's not so much just, let's kiss this guy's rear end to get out of him what we want. That typical constituent politician relationship. I'm going to use the analogy I used at because we were talking about this in my small group last night, because my small group asked me about this. So let me use the analogy that I used with them, okay? And this is coming from, you know, a fellow individual of Italian descent, okay? It's like the Godfather. It's like an it's like an appreciation. It's hard to explain. I've never really seen anything like it, honestly. It's like, hey, thank you for what you did for us. And, you know, and we want to acknowledge and pay that honor. It's not a quid pro quo, like your traditional thing where you're around it and you kind of feel slimy in a way, you know, the access-based system. It's really like, hey, you know what, man? You cleaned out all the banditos in this town. And it's safe for my kids to walk the street. My daughter's getting married tomorrow. You know, my saloon is open and doesn't get shot up after every poker game. You don't ever have to buy a beer in this joint ever again. That kind of a thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And I've never seen anything like it, ever. It's just an appreciation. And he has like no, like, uppity aura about him. He walked in, you know, Monday night with jeans, boots, and a button-down shirt. In fact, one of his staff called me ahead of time and said, hey, just wanted to make sure you're not overdressed for this thing. That's the first time in my career anyone's ever called me and said, make sure you're not overdressed for this. Okay? It's just, I mean, it is a true appreciation for, hey, we appreciate your leadership and what you did for us and our families and our state. We're just appreciative.
Well, that harkens back historically to how things worked. I mean, ultimately, we the people, you do work for us. But people, understand this within the context of saying it. People really want to elect and then appreciate their betters. Not in terms of fundamentally better as a human being in any way, but somebody who has a track record of accomplishment, who's from our tribe and is like, here, this is our champion.
A champion.
Yes.
That's a great term for it.
That's what's happening here.
That's a better analogy than I came up with.
Well, you inspired it because it's true.
But I mean, it is literally, hey, you agreed to jump on the noble steed and go into battle for us, okay? And you did, okay? And we want to honor that. We're thankful. And it's not like grifty or, okay, how can I get, you know, a seat at the table kind of stuff? Because frankly, one of his weaknesses, if we're being brutally honest as a politician, is he's not into the patronage thing of politics at all. Even to the point of his own detriment. Doesn't mean he has to go full Trumpian, where if I just slobber on the guy, I get whatever I want, no matter what my beliefs are. But we are human beings, you know? I mean, I got a text yesterday from someone who spent some of their own political capital, no question, advocating for the governor as president, and kind of feels like maybe someone should have called and thanked me or something. That is something that's just kind of not who he is, because he so disdains the grift aspect of this. He like doesn't even do it to the level he maybe should. So it's not like any form of a quid pro quo. It's like an honorarium. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were the champion we picked. You did the job. The realm is safe, and here is our honor. And we want to give you the honor that you are deserving of.
I respect you people so much for putting me here. I'm going to give you my best. I can do no other. I stand.
I mean, it's not something I've seen a lot of. Not even here in Iowa.
It's one thing to do that in a place like Iowa or a place like Kansas or a place like Nebraska and the flyover country where the demographics are basically all tilted to one side. To do that in a place like Florida, I mean, in this ruling from the federal judge about the, you know, upholding that newly drawn congressional district, which got rid of a black majority district, I believe. Mm-hmm. Well, the judge ruled that it was the new district that they redrew, which gave, again, the Republicans the majority in the House of Representatives. They ruled that it was a minority district. To go from Dixie to a cultural epicenter in Miami and have that level of seemingly universal praise and admiration, I guess, that's difficult to do. And the question then becomes, and I think we all know the answer to this. Why isn't this done in a place like Iowa, which we've done our best? Why isn't this done in a place like Kansas, where they have a Democrat governor right now, or Nebraska? Missouri is you know, decent.
How about all these southern red states?
Exactly.
West Virginia, Mississippi,
and now you
Alabama.
Know, and now you know why certain people continue to dump on the guy. Now you know.
Because he's making them look bad.
Correct.
That Babylon Bee headline, I mean, he just gets too much stuff done. I mean, honestly, I don't even know if that's satire. I don't. I
tried to eject him from the Republican Party.
I think it's when we were talking. I mean, we were talking about some of the issues that he's dealing with in Florida as part of our conversation back privately. And one of the things, and I'm just listening to this because you guys know I've had a lot of these kinds of conversations with politicians in my career. A lot. Okay. Again, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, even here in Iowa, as much as we love Kim Reynolds, it's like an extraordinary thing that she forced the legislature to come back to a special session to deal with an issue, right? Okay, that's like an extraordinary lift to try to get your Republican governor to, after the session ends, bring everybody back because they didn't finish the job, okay, and bring everybody back to finish the damn job they were all originally sent there to do. That's one of the hardest things to ask a Republican executive in your state to do anywhere. He's just like casually telling me, I don't even remember what the legislation was now. It was just like, yeah, I want to get to work on that piece of as well. I don't know if they'll get to it this legislative session. If they don't, I'll just call them back in the dead of summer and they'll get to it then. And it's not like it's like a, oh yeah, macho man, yeah. It's not like that.
Killer
dude,
nerd.
Yeah, just dude, exactly. Like an alpha nerd. Dude's just sitting in the chair backstage at this church and we're just two guys wearing jeans and a blazer, okay? That's like over a beer. He's like, yeah, they'll get it done. If not, I'll just call him back and we'll get it done then because it's got to happen. So we'll make it so. And it's not like, you know, like we're not like there's no like, you know, heat lamps. We're not, you know, vamping. It's just a matter of fact, ruthless efficiency. It's the right thing to do. So I'm just, it's my job to make sure they do it. And I'll do that. That's my job.
Yeah, he's the political version of faith without works is dead. He's not, it's not like the tone in his voice who he might meet. No, he's like, everybody around him is like, he's going to do it. He's really going to make us come back. I mean, because he's done the thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take that many times. It might take more than once. It might take more than one. But you get it that third time, it's like, yeah, that's not talk. That's just going to happen. So we might as well take this on now.
And the embodiment of character matters, too. He wouldn't be able to show this level of resolve if he didn't have high character. If there were some bones in his closet from years ago, do you think we would have heard about that?
Gosh.
We would have heard that 500 times.
Are there a few major media markets in the state of Florida that would love to drive that narrative if they could? Yes, of course. It is. It's a complete outlier. It's unlike anything I've ever witnessed or seen. And at the end of the conversation, he asked me, hey, you know what? Because we talk some personal stuff. We talk plenty of political stuff. At the end, he asked me, he said, hey, you do this every day. What do you think we should be working on that we're not doing right now? I was stumped. I was.
Dace has been broken.
I didn't know what to say. I really didn't. I was
by
stumped.
Excellence.
I was gobsmacked. And I'm like, remember that time you did Abbey Road? That was great.
Chocolate,
you know.
Vanilla,
I didn't know what to do.
Strawberry.
Yeah. And so I just looked at him and I said, honestly, Ron, you guys have a, we've said this on our show for the last couple of years. You and your team have a tendency down here to just kind of do the stuff that we sit on our show and think if we had an extra day or two to think about, we'd want somebody to do something. And that's kind of what you all do. I don't really know.
Iowa evangelicals, your thoughts.
And so I was like, I guess just keep doing what you're doing. It's my best advice. You know, I mean, I don't know what to say, you know.
That's hilarious because,
I mean, if I had more time to think about it, I could.
Oh, no. Well,
but the fact that
know.
I don't instantly at the ready have like a laundry list for a politician of things I want them to do, I think is something, you
but
know.
You love it, and rightly so. You like being asked questions unprepared, which is why you don't. Same thing. A politician asks Steve Dace, what are your thoughts? He's like, you want me to talk about myself, don't you? You're like, it's
funny
odd.
You bring that up. I brought a few of those with me.
And here Steve's just like, am I on camera? What? What?
Yeah, I mean, I froze. I was like, anyway, about Epic Adventure, you said that's going to be really good, right? I mean, I didn't know what to say, you know? And he's, you know, I've said on this show many times that politicians are almost always reflections of the era in which they come from. They very rarely transcend the era. And when they do, they're momentous examples that everybody easily recalls, like a Winston Churchill, for example. And what Ron DeSantis, he'll be the first one to tell you as a history guy, what he's done in Florida is noteworthy, but it's nothing compared to what Winston Churchill was facing. Literally, the whole of Western civilization rested upon, from an earthly perspective anyway, rested upon his shoulders for a not insignificant amount of time.
Okay? Yet his own people, before and after the war, rejected him as well.
Yeah, and how did they repay him, though? Because he delivered in that moment. They rejected him in the very next election. You know, and I think, honestly, I just think in the end, for where this electorate is and our expectation level, we're not ready for the guy to marry yet. We still need the guy in the man bun on the motorcycle to leave us at home in a hotel room pregnant a few more times.
One of the best measures of how corrupt a country is how rich its leaders get while they're in office. They're not so good at passing laws or governing, but they're great at investing.
Imagine if every American could make money off of war.
In 103 days, that position ends up gaining around 103%. So she made, you know, $2 million plus her original two, so $4
million. I signed, co-sponsored a bill and made too much voluminous flair over it that I wouldn't be seated. So I shut up. The threats that fly around are just absolutely insane.
The Blaze Originals team traveled to Washington, D.C., home to one of the most brilliant financial minds in the world, Nancy Pelosi. In our documentary, Bought and Paid For, How Politicians Get Filthy Rich, we spoke to reps Matt Gaetz and Chip Roy, George Santos, and the bane of D.C. elites, Unusual Whales, to expose how our elected officials are beating the stock market and, more importantly, what we can do. To watch today, go to congressgetsrich.com and use code RICH to get $30 off an annual subscription to Blaze TV.
So a lot of the financial experts thought we were in the clear. They were anticipating maybe a half dozen rate cuts by the feds this year. Now the Fed came out last week and said, maybe we'll have three, maybe, you know, try to see if that's enough to risk more inflation, to pump enough sunshine into the economy for Operation Reelect Joe, right? Friends, this stuff's not going away because of the decisions we've made since this time 4 years ago. So, and that's one of the reasons right now we're $34 trillion in the hole. And if we keep printing money, it's going to keep pushing prices higher. So you can either bury your head in the sand or you can do something about it. One thing you can do about it right now, diversify a portion of your savings into gold with Birch Gold Group. Use gold as your hedge against inflation, and Birch Gold makes it easy to own to do just that. They'll help you convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and you don't have to pay a penny out of pocket to make it so. So if you want to get started, text Steve to 989-898. Get your free info kit on gold, and they'll hook you up with a precious metals specialist to help you protect your savings, your prosperity from persistent inflation, to government debasement, managed decline with gold. Text Steve to 989-898 now. That's text Steve to 989-898 now. His name is Brad Wilcox. His new book is called Get Married. Very direct title. Good to have you back, Brad, from the Marriage Project here on The Blaze, brother. How are you?
Doing well, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So I don't know, Brad, why you think... I want to take issue with the title, because I'm not entirely sure why you think a book titled this is needed right now. I mean, we are living at a time that, for the first time in American history, a 25-year-old male is more likely to be living at home with a parent still than living in another home married with a wife as a parent. I don't know why you would view that as a troubling development in the trajectory of our society, Brad. Please do tell.
Yeah, well, actually, what we know, Steve, is that there's a lot of voices out there telling us on the left and the right that the path to sort of prosperity and happiness runs away from marriage and family. We saw a piece in the New York Times not too long ago that said that married motherhood in America is a game no one wins, sort of on the left, targeting women, basically. Now we're on the right. As you know, we're hearing voices like Andrew Tate telling us that there's really no return on investment for marriage for men, the kind of guy you were just talking about, you know, in your comments just a minute ago. But the reality, the truth is that there are no groups of both women and men today in America, Steve, who are more likely to be flourishing, both financially, actually, and then also when it comes to emotional outcomes like happiness, than married moms and married dads. So there's just kind of a gap right there in the sort of public discourse on marriage and family today that we're kind of working against, where a lot of people are being told that they should steer clear of marriage and family. And yet the data keep telling us that those are the things that kind of lead us to both financial security typically and then a meaningful and happy life as well.
So you kind of did an end run there, but you're basically addressing the so-called red pill movement.
Correct.
Which is basically, from a worldview standpoint, it's a rebranding of, I guess we would call it, Bronze Age or Greco-Roman pre-Christendom understanding of humanity and worldview, or kind of a godless, if there's a such thing as a godless honor society, this would kind of be it, right? That it's basically honor.
Also,
go ahead. I'll let you finish. Go ahead.
And a kind of Nietzschean, it's very Nietzschean as well, too. It's about strength. It's about individuality. It's about not becoming dependent upon someone else. You know, it's about not kind of entering into some kind of, obviously, lifelong communion. It's all about kind of basically, you know, keeping your own strength to your own self and pursuing your own short-term either desires or sort of understanding of excellence in a certain kind of very narrow way.
And those themes in a certain context would be enticing to people of a conservative or a traditional bent, right? But in this kind of a movement, we're really there's no cornerstone, there's no fulcrum, no plumb line, and so it's honor for honor's sake. The individual now doesn't have rights that come from God, like the founding creed of this country says, but the individual gets to essentially put themselves in the place of God. And so
correct.
And so we kind of go from government is God, which is what the other side believes, and we'll talk about them in a minute where marriage is concerned. But now we're kind of saying you're kind of your own God. No one is the boss of you, and anything that asks anything of you other than the fulfillment of your desires is bad, basically.
Right. So it's a profoundly individualistic model that makes the self the sovereign. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And what are they missing? Tell them, Brad, what your data shows they're missing out on. Like, I can't get enough of pictures of my first granddaughter right now. I mean, honestly, if Anastasia just absolutely sent me 10,000 of them every 5 minutes, my oldest daughter, I would be like, keep them coming. I can't get enough of it. Okay, so tell me where that instinct comes from, and where the Andrew Tates of the world, that I am a law unto myself and it's all about me, what they're then therefore missing out on by not having these kinds of exchanges with their children like I am at the moment.
Yeah, so I mean, even obviously in the sort of classical tradition, Steve, we see Aristotle talking about the reality that we're social animals, is his terminology. I think that points us to this idea that we're most likely to flourish when we're in relationships with other people, friendships, and especially, I would say, family relationships, especially marriage. And so we see is when, you know, men and women are kind of both getting care, but also giving care towards other, kind of they're in relationships with other people in profound ways, they're much more likely to flourish because we're kind of hardwired to connect is sort of my thinking on this question. And so when it comes to men, for instance, to kind of, you know, hit the red pill right, what we see is that about 39% of married dads are very happy with their lives. You know, I think compared to about 14% of, you know, unmarried and childless guys, you know. So the kind of guy who's kind of doing the Andrew Tate thing, at least in the larger population, is a lot less happy than the kind of guy who's doing, you know, the Steve and Brad thing, being married fathers, right? So that's what the data tell us. And then for, you know, the folks on the left who are arguing that women should steer clear of marriage and motherhood, again, what we see is that married moms are the happiest group in the United States. In that 18-55 bracket, they're almost twice as likely to be very happy compared to their single and childless female peers. So for both men and women, we see a very strong connection, not just between marriage and family and happiness, but also other outcomes like loneliness and meaning. So Americans, both women and men who are married with kids, report much more meaningful lives, which is also obviously incredibly important, and they're a lot less lonely. And that's especially, I think, noteworthy in a day and age when we're seeing deaths of despair skyrocket in this country. And we have a recent study from Jonathan Rothwell at Gallup that looked at deaths of despair in particular. And what he found was that from a regional perspective, the number one factor in his analyses was how much kind of, or how many adults in a region were unmarried. That was kind of the biggest factor in his model. So again, when people are not getting married, not having families, they're much more vulnerable, not just to being unhappy, but even to deaths of despair.
I think the key word that you use there in that excellent answer is hardwiring.
Yes.
Because if that hardwiring exists, then attempts that we make to find contentment, happiness, or to use the biblical term for it, joy, the attempts that we would make to find that outside of that hardwiring just will not end. It's impossible for that to end well. It's just a matter of whether it's we die alone, we have, you know, all of a sudden when my hormones slow down in my 40s and 50s and just, you know, having the maximum output of orgasms I can produce is not, you know, the most, you know, a prominent thing on my mind anymore, but now I've got nobody to share a life with, et cetera, et cetera. I've caused other people heartache because of my pursuing of my own glands above all other things. That disavowing and ignoring that hardwiring can only lead to some form of negativity. We're only just going to find out for each individual person how negative we're talking, basically.
And we all know, too, that there, I mean, I've got friends who are single or flourishing, but I'm just saying kind of for the average person, both the average man and the average woman, what we do see is they're more likely to be flourishing when they are married, when they do have kids, and they have, you know, lots of opportunities both to receive care but also to give care. I think for men especially, we need to realize kind of being the Lone Ranger, while sort of attractive in some ways in this culture, I think particularly for younger men, there's really no comparison, you know, to kind of every night, basically, I have a twin who's 14 years old, and she'll kind of hunt me down in the house, and she'll give me a kiss on the forehead, or she'll just give me a hug. And, you know, when you're in midlife, I'm 53, I mean, you just can't put a price tag right on that, Steve.
No.
And right. So to think that you would be kind of living at age 53 with no one to kind of, you know, care for, no one who cares about you in some kind of profound way, I think it's just, I mean, I can't even begin to wrap my head around that. So that's the kind of, I think, idea that, you know, younger men who are listening, Andrew Tate, need to sort of take more seriously.
All right, so we've addressed the tall tale, the red pill right is telling men. And then we've talked about what the progressive left is saying to women. All right, let's get to what's in your subtitle. Why Americans must defy the elites, forge strong families, and save civilization. The last time we had you on, you pointed out that a lot of our institutional elites actually, in their own lives, value marriage, and are living that way. Even though many of the doctrines and dogmas that they are perpetuating in their institutions are antithetical to that. Go back into that for us again. Re-explain that disconnect to us. Maybe tell us what would be the purpose of that. Why would you not want to recommend to people that which has been a blessing to you? Okay, what would be your motivation for that? And why is it that we do see many of the elite institutions in our country now trying to undermine the data that you're presenting to us?
Yeah, so it's fascinating kind of when you look at how many elites, I'm talking about in journalism, talking about in the academy, talking about in public, you know, schools, Hollywood moguls, now and C-suite executives, you know, you kind of look at what they do in private, Steve, versus what they say in public or don't say in public. And so what you see in kind of on the public stage is you have plenty of elites who are kind of giving either, you know, full-throated endorsement of what I call family diversity theory, the idea that every family form is equally valuable, or just kind of cats got, you know, their tongue when it comes to marriage. They don't talk about it. They don't want to talk about it. But you look at their private lives and they're often stably married with kids. And there's either a kind of implicit, I think, appreciation for marriage and family, or even maybe an explicit one, but not one they're going to share in public. I mean, I had a dean, for instance, at UVA come up to you at one point and just say, you know, love your work, Brad, at the National Marriage Project. But this guy would kind of never publicly, you know, talk about that. So why is that? Well, I think it's because, you know, in public, marriage has become coded as conservative. And it's also the case, too, that, you know, more progressive thinking about kind of new family forms gets a lot of cachet, you know, in elite circles. And so people kind of want to signal in public that they kind of have the right way of thinking about family life. They're also, I think, often tempted to kind of baptize the latest, you know, cultural innovation that's come down the pike, even though they may not personally kind of, you know, do that themselves. So obviously polyamory is the most recent example of this. It's gotten kind of favorable coverage in the New York Times and in New York Magazine. There's a new series on Peacock, I think, called From Couple to Throuple. So kind of polyamory is having a moment right now. But I think most of the executives at Peacock who would be kind of behind this series, most of the journalists who are writing about it, you know, most of the other people who might kind of give it some kind of nominal support or assent, wouldn't do it for themselves, recognizing that having a polyamorous relationship gets extremely complicated. And I think most of us who are married with kids, you know, it's sort of for me to kind of give my wife enough time and attention, you know, that she deserves. The idea that I could add someone else to the mix is just mind-boggling. Also wouldn't go over very well on the home front, right? So I just think that there are all these things out there on the sort of family front and other fronts culturally happening that kind of get, you know, some kind of endorsement from some kind of, you know, elite cultural institution, and then elites feel like they have to kind of, you know, give their assent to them and even support them in public. But they recognize at some level that stable marriage is best for them, their spouse, their kids, and their 401k, not to mention their home, right? And so that's why when you look at their private lives, they're often living what I call kind of a neo-traditional family lifestyle.
Good answer. I've got about a minute here. Why would getting married help to save civilization?
Well, I'm actually sitting here almost in the shadow of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, and he's talked about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration. Just take life and then happiness, pursuit of happiness. We know, again, like I mentioned before, deaths of despair, one of the biggest factors there now and why that's rising in America is so many Americans are not married. And then when it comes to we're seeing happiness in America, the pursuit of happiness is now much more difficult for Americans. And we've seen the research from the University of Chicago telling us, again, the number one factor that accounts for falling rates of happiness in America is the fact that fewer Americans are finding a way to put a ring on it or to stay stably married. So when families are strong, America is strong. But when the family is weak, America is weaker as well.
Excellent stuff as always, Brad. Get his book, Get Married, Why Americans Must Defy the Elites, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization. It's always good to have you on, brother. Thank you very much. Appreciate your work.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. By the way, guys, do you know what the number one voting marker in America is? Number one tell of how someone is going to vote?
Whether they're married.
Whether they're married or not. Number one. Number one voting marker. If you are married, you are more likely to vote Republican. And if you are single, you are more likely to vote Democratic. That is the number one voting marker in America. Right there. Thoughts?
I would just like to say, if there are any pastors, elders, youth pastors listening right now, I have seen data from a few different places that suggests Gen Z young men are moving, identifying as right wing, whatever the heck that means. If that is the case, I would postulate that that means that there is some degree of hunger for actual masculinity amongst Gen Z young men. If that is the case, here are the choices pastors, elders, youth pastors, our young men in this generation, in my generation, honestly, have been given, but increasingly so as time wears on. We've got the Andrew Tate Genghis Khan School of Masculinity, which is conquer and spread your seed far and wide with no regard for human dignity whatsoever. Or, on the other hand, you have the Mike Pence Pius Eunuch University. Those are both two ditches. Your job, and especially fathers as well of young men, your job is to point your sons, those who are young men in your care, on the narrow path, which means self-sacrifice, but not being a doormat. So I think part and parcel to this conversation is the state of the young men. There's a big conversation we could have about the state of the young women as well, because the same data that I've seen showing young men in this generation, Gen Z, are moving to the right, the young women continue to move to the left, and there's different schools of femininity, whether it's the trad wife stereotype that's rife, at least on Twitter right now, or the Taylor Swift, I'm constantly breaking up with guys, into perpetuity. Those are also ditches as well. But your job and your care is to point your sons and daughters on the narrow way.
Amen. We'll come back and it will begin our Theology Thursday study of the Book of Romans. Stay tuned. And we're back with Hour 2 here on Blaze TV, radio, and podcast. Steve Dace here with Aaron McIntyre and Todd Erzin. Let us know what you think about what we think via the SteveDace.com inbox by emailing us, steve@stevedace.com. That's D-E-A-C-E. Like us on Facebook, MeWe and Gab. You can follow me at Steve Day Show on Twitter, Gitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And you can also, if you are a podcast listener and wouldn't mind doing this, leave us a 5-star review if you don't mind the show. Even if you like it, we would appreciate that. Thank you to every single one of you that has done that for us previously. Also, make sure to hit subscribe or follow if it's iTunes that you podcast from. That way, every time we do a new episode, it will show up in your feed every single time. And this part of the show brought to you by our friends over at Hillsdale. I know we are so concerned, many of us are right now, about the direction of the country. They've got so many vital free online courses available for you at Hillsdale. One in particular, given what is happening in the country right now, you want to check out, is American Citizenship and Its Decline from noted historian Victor Davis Hanson. It's a course that traces the history of citizenship. It explains how it's being undermined in America today by open borders, identity politics, and more, and why that is fundamental to the undermining of the country as well. If you want to take this free online course, it's called, again, American Citizenship and Its Decline by Victor Davis Hanson. Just go to Dace for Hillsdale, F-O-R, daceforhillsdale.com. That's daceforhillsdale.com. You can start your free course today at daceforhillsdale.com. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we're going to be joined in advance of Holy Weekend here by my good friend Dr. Jeremiah Johnston from the C.S. Lewis Society and Prestonwood Baptist Church on evidences for the resurrection. He'll join us here at the bottom of the hour. For those of you that were like, come on, man, you cannot play that long of a clip of Joel Osteen and then not have any response to that tripe. You're right. Which is why we're going to have our overtime about that today. For Blaze TV subscribers, go to blazetv.com/dace. That's blazetv.com/dace. By the way, tomorrow for Blaze TV subscribers at 1:30 Central, I'm doing another off-the-record Ask Me Anything just for Blaze TV subscribers. So you get 2-for-1 now. You get to see our continued more thorough analysis of the deconstruction of the Christian faith, which is a nice way of saying heresy. That you heard from Joel Osteen and Aaron's montage, and you get to be a part of tomorrow's off-the-record Ask Me Anything at 1:30 Central Time here on Blaze TV as well. BlazeTV.com/Dace is where you want to go to watch that later today and subscribe. That's BlazeTV.com/Dace. So let us begin. We're going to get into today an introduction into the book of Romans. It's only the second Bible study we've ever done on the show. The previous one, we did the book of Colossians, and we chose that book because it's not the first Christology that is introduced in the New Testament, but it's the first fully developed one that is. And I know we have a lot of views on that particular issue theologically within this audience. So I thought, let's go ahead and just tackle that right from the outset and make sure everybody knows where everybody stands. And if we're going to do a show based on biblical worldview, we ought to probably let everybody know what understanding of the biblical worldview we're all, at least that are doing this show, we're all coming from, right? Well, now when we get to the book of Romans, I'll go into a more thorough introduction here in a moment. What we're really talking about now is the full embodiment and practical application of a biblical worldview. So when I told you guys, let's start here. When I told you guys at the beginning of the year, I was thinking of going here for Theology Thursday. What were your unvarnished initial thoughts?
Excellent, because it's going to be messy. No pretense. No, we will solve all our problems. We're getting into this. In every one of our books, different introductions should say something like, all of the greats has wrestled with this book, mm-hmm. and we still don't have a definitive accounting that everybody agrees upon. This is going to be hard. It's going to be challenging. Everybody is going to have to truly discover if they know the meaning of grace or not and how we approach this.
What was it, 2017, 2018, during the anniversary? I think it was the 500th anniversary. Maybe it wasn't 2019, but it was
2017.
Yeah. 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Both of you guys duked it out for a series of, I don't know how many weeks, it seemed like it was half the year, on the issue of the Reformation. Now, the problem is that our show was in this format in its nascent stages, and so it was much, much,
pre-Blaze.
It was much smaller than it is now. And it's a shame that not as many people got to hear those conversations, in my estimation. I think this will accomplish kind of a redux of that conversation in maybe an even richer way than we saw before. Because how many times do we reference and channel the book of Romans on the show? It's like every single day, because it's applicable, especially Romans chapter 1, every single day. And so I think going through it, who knows how long, with no time limit necessarily in terms of the length or duration, how many months we go through it. I think this is going to be a very valuable thing, not only for the three of us here. During the break, I actually just purchased the R.C. Sproul commentary, The Righteous Shall Live by Faith, the commentary on Romans. So it's going to be kind of three different perspectives, slightly varying probably, or maybe varying a lot. It's going to be enriching, I think, for all of us on here, and I think for those listening as well. Maybe infuriating at times, but I think it's going to be good.
So you mentioned what is going to be kind of your North Star as we go through this study. I'm going to be using Spurgeon's Verse Exposition on Romans. So this is what that book looks like. A lot of you have emailed me and asked me about it. Why did I choose Spurgeon? Just as I've said before, he is considered by many the greatest English-speaking preacher that ever lived. And so I figured let's go at least with one of the best. All right. So this is Spurgeon's Verse Exposition of Romans. Todd, for you guys, your team, you're going with who?
I'm going with Scott Hahn, former evangelical preacher who got so deep into the scriptures, he turned Catholic. So there you have it.
I think that's valuable because he's going to understand, at least on some level, fundamentally where people like us are coming from.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that these will be very important conversations. And do you guys have any hesitancy at all about what we are about to do?
Nope.
I mean, I'm sure there's I think we've
all. Of course, the guy who thinks vinegar is a delicacy has no reservations at all.
I mean,
what about you, Aaron?
I was actually going back through some of our conversations. I think you jokingly said one time, maybe we shouldn't do this because people are not prepared. I think we've all had at various points some amount of, man, are people really ready for this type of conversation? But most of us aren't ready for many conversations anyway in life.
Yeah.
So let's just do it. Let's rip the Band-Aid off. Let's just jump into the deep end. Let's get it done.
I decided to do this now for two reasons. One, I think we're more ready as a show and the relationship we have with our audience than we ever have been before to do this. Even if we're not actually ready, we're readier. We're closer to be ready to being ready than we've ever been. And the moment has to be ready. Where we are at culturally right now has to be ready. And if, frankly, we wait until we're all in a place where we're comfortable enough with one another, we can broach these topics and no one's panties are going to get into a bunch.
We'll be in the catacombs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. And so we're the readiest I think we can be for the moment that is more than ready for it, I think. So let's talk about Romans. And you know, we're talking about maybe a top three most debated book in all of the Bible. How monumental is this book? How important is it to the framework of the Christian faith? Well, Romans is the book that Luther said inspired him to spark the Reformation. One of the most pivotal moments, regardless of which side of the fence you're on, one of the most pivotal moments really in the history of humanity, but in particular, the Christian faith. Another pre-Luther would-be reformer, Tyndale, he called it, quote, the most excellent part of the New Testament. Augustine. So this is going to be a theologian that Todd and I are both going to hold in very high regard. Augustine said it was the reading a copy of Romans that belonged to a friend of his that prompted him to leave his sex cult behind and become a Christian. He later wrote in his own work, Confessions, that through Romans, quote, a light flooded my heart and all the darkness of doubt vanished away, end quote. Keep in mind that it could be argued that post-Bible writing times, the most impactful, influential theologian of the Christian faith is Augustine. Certainly in the pre-Reformation era, that is indebatable, that's indisputable, the reformers were heavily influenced by Augustine, in fact, and in some respects, some of the reformers were pushing, I mean, remember, Luther himself was an Augustinian monk, were pushing for a return to an Augustinian understanding of doctrine and where the church was, in their mind anyway. So you're talking for the guy that is post-Bible times, the most influential theologian in the history of the faith, this was the book that led to his own conversion. That tells you how monumental it is. Needless to say, we are about to tackle one of the greatest written works in all of creation. Therefore, let each of us, on every end of this conversation, humbly treat it with the reverence that it deserves. This epistle or letter is one of the mightiest works of God that this planet has ever seen. It still stands today as the greatest apologetic in the history of Christendom. It is the rare book of the Bible both unbeliever and immature believer alike try to steer clear from, because you cannot give Romans an honest reading and come back unchanged. It's impossible. So along those lines, let me have some further comments about what we are about to discuss and kind of set the stage from an introduction standpoint of the era in which this book comes from. This letter from the Apostle Paul to the church in Rome, it's likely dated about a quarter century after the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. By this time, there was already a large and vibrant group of believers there in Rome, since Paul himself says in the letter that he has longed to visit them for many years. Also, the letter is unique in its advanced and detailed theology, which may indicate that Paul assumed the body of believers there were so well established that they were ready for some very specific cultural applications that to us may seem metaphorical or not understandable, but to them would have absolutely been as applicable as imaginable for the times in which they lived. They would have understood exactly what it was he was referring to with some of these instances like meat sacrifice to idols and things of that nature. All right. Now, Paul was martyred by Nero, the Emperor Nero, and probably no later than 68 AD. So that would mean before the Roman destruction of Jerusalem. And that would likely put this letter or epistle right in the middle of the years that he is believed by most sources to have written all of his letters, which is between 48 and 65 AD. This also gives further evidence to the resurrection, actually. We're going to talk more about that next segment with Dr. Jeremiah Johnston. But if you see how quickly a religion based on the claim of a dead miracle worker coming back to life spread throughout ancient Rome, at a time the most powerful empire in the world wasn't exactly sympathetic to it, in a certain fashion that lends credence to the basis for that claim. Hard to spread something that fast against that much power based on a lie. This is the generation of people who likely would have witnessed that event, or known people firsthand who did. And the New Testament says Christ appeared to hundreds, the resurrected Christ appeared to hundreds of people. So some of those people would have been in the Roman, in the congregation there, or they would have known of those people who said, yeah, I encountered him. There is simply no way a religion founded on such an outlandish claim would have survived all the persecution it received, let alone thrived as it did in spite of that persecution, if it were all just a tall tale or a hoax. The pressure to bear culturally to recant was just too great. There's also an intra-religion debate among Jews that is raging during this era as well. Paul himself started out among those Jews who did not believe this Yeshua, that's Jesus' Hebrew name, this carpenter Yeshua of Nazareth was Messiah. He was on his way to a place called Antioch in Syria to confront and arrest Jews who did. By the way, this is where the Jewish believers, there were no other kind yet. This is where Jewish believers in Yeshua as Messiah were first referred to as Christians in Antioch, Syria, and it was not a compliment. They didn't come up with that branding on their own. They thought they were Jews who just, you know, believed in Messiah, the fulfillment of the nation of Israel's primary mission on earth. And so the term Christians was given to them as a pejorative. It was on his way there to Antioch, or what is also known as the road to Damascus, that Paul encountered the risen Christ, and that conversion began his own spiritual journey from skeptic and persecutor to believer and apostle. And not just any apostle, he now became the apostle to the Gentiles, the Hebrew of Hebrews, as he describes himself in one of his letters. Paul, therefore, went from confronting Messianic Jews with what he believed was their heresy to confronting local Jewish synagogues throughout the empire with what he now believed was evidence that Jesus was indeed Lord, including Christ's fulfillment of biblical prophecy pertaining to the Messiah. And keep in mind, the only Bible at the time that existed is what we call the Old Testament today. Much of the New Testament, as we now know it, is being terraformed in this very era. Okay, so he is reasoning with his fellow Jews from their shared revelation, the Old Testament, or the Law, the Prophets, the Pentateuch. Though Christianity at first was an exclusive Jewish debate about whether or not Yeshua of Nazareth was truly the promised one, the anointed one, the Christ, Rome was unique in that it was among the first diverse enclaves of Christianity, with Jew and Gentile, or non-Jewish, Jew and Gentile believers alike, worshiping together. Thus, this was a diverse community of believers that needed help navigating the cultural challenges that were facing them from both an intrusive and pagan government, which viewed itself as basically all-powerful, but also their own friends and family members who thought they had abandoned their heritage, whether Jew or Gentile, to follow a dead false prophet. They were under constant pressure to renounce their to either renounce their faith or reduce it, at least to the point of making it compatible with what was culturally acceptable at the time. Let me say that again. They were under constant pressure. This congregation, which would have been Jew and Gentile alike, a rarity at that point, they would have been under constant pressure to either renounce their faith or reduce it to that which would make it compatible with what was considered culturally acceptable at the time. Does any of that sound familiar to Christians today? Furthermore, Romans was written to Christians living in a negative world, just as we are today. Let me explain what that means. Throughout the history of the Christian faith, the pattern has been negative to neutral to positive. All right, meaning the faith is introduced into a culture that is instantly negative, hostile to it, because it's a challenge. It's an existential challenge to that which that culture currently esteems. Think of it, can be what a culture financially esteems. It gets in the way of profit. Think of Paul in Ephesus, all right, where the worship of Artemis or Diana is so fundamental to the culture of that time that the selling and peddling of wares is really the biggest industry in that economy. So it's not just that what Paul is introducing through Jesus of Nazareth is going to challenge, if not completely eradicate, the claims of the Greco-Roman pantheon. It's that Greco-Roman pantheon is lining a lot of pockets and putting food on a lot of people's tables. On a very, forget a high-minded theological conversation like Paul is having with the scholarly Jews at Mars Hill, the Areopagus. This is just flat out, mama's got to eat. I mean, if people stop buying these idols, we're all going broke. So it can be a very practical challenge to what that culture esteems. It could be the theological challenges. It could be the philosophical challenges. So if for example, one of the persecutions that was offered the early church, post-Caesar, his nephew Augustine takes over. He's the first Roman emperor to declare himself to be, or Augustus, I should say. He's the first Roman emperor to declare himself to be God. Virtually every Roman emperor after him tried some variation of this theme. Well, we've got a problem here, right here in River City, folks. Because if Caesar is God, then guess what Jesus can't be? God. Okay? So if Caesar's Lord, Jesus can't be Lord. And if Jesus is Lord, guess what Caesar can't be? Lord. So we've got a problem. And so Christians were often threatened that they had to renounce their faith by saying things like Kaiser Kyrios, which is Latin for Caesar is Lord, as opposed to Christos Kyrios, which is for instead, no, Jesus or Christ is Lord. Okay, so they were under these constant negative challenges because the introduction of Christianity ran perpendicular, not parallel like many churches do today. Like many churches in the West do, where we're preaching some form of orthodoxy over here on this really nice campus or in this really nice building, but across the street, all hell is literally breaking loose. Abaddon, the pit is open. The abyss has been opened. The Black Gate of Mordor has fallen, and the orcs are flooding the culture. But you wouldn't know it if you went to this church. They're kind of preaching in this hermetically sealed environment, never intersects with the evil in the world whatsoever, because they think if we just stay here in our own private little Idaho, then they'll just let us stay here and preach the gospel into perpetuity. And no, they won't. They're just waiting until they surround you, and then they're going to take you out. We're meant to be a perpendicular force. And so prior to America, the church was always, always, always planted in a negative culture. Every time. Every single time. Even post-Reformation, this is the case as Christianity is sweeping the globe. Because now we're dealing with territorial and tribal disputes where Catholic monarchs would target Protestants and Protestant monarchs would target Catholics. So if you were on the wrong side of that divide, you're in a negative culture too. It could even get negative with among even people of the same sect. As I pointed out 2 years ago when I released Why Thanksgiving, the pilgrims were not fleeing Mary, Queen of Bloody Mary. The pilgrims were not fleeing the Moors. They were fleeing the Protestant King of England. The Church of England was telling them, you can't preach the word of God now. So now we've got Protestants going after targeting Protestants. All right, so the church has always been planted prior to this country in a negative culture. And so then it gets to the stage of neutrality, which is there's some point in time where a critical mass has been built. Continuing to persecute the church is just not feasible. Or at the very least, you know, like when the first pilgrims, they settled on the Dutch colony there. The Dutch government still didn't like them all that much, but appreciated the fact they were really good citizens that raised good kids and good people. And they had a clean community that was not rife with crime and drunkenness like many of the others. So they're at least willing to tolerate it. They're neutral to it. They're not advocating for it, but they're going to allow it because overall it doesn't either get in their way or it feeds their narrative at the time. And then there is the positive environment, right? And so Rome goes from persecuting Christianity to permitting Christianity to Constantine making Christianity the religion of Rome. And this is now where it is the driving force culturally in the culture in which it primarily resides. When this country was founded, this process began opposite of how it's worked in every other culture prior to America. When this country was founded, because it was inspired by people who came here for the advancement of the Christian religion, as they put right in their own founding charter, it started in a positive environment. And Christianity is the driving force in this country, or at least there is no cultural influence greater than it, until pretty much the 1960s. Doesn't mean Christianity was always right. Doesn't mean the church always put its best foot forward. Did I say it was perfect? Did I say it was best behaved? Is that what I said?
No.
Did I say it was a Pax Americana year in and year out? Is that what I said?
No.
No. But the essence of Christianity, its moral teachings, the understanding of what it means that Christ was resurrected, was the driving cultural influence in this country until about the 1960s. What happened then? Well, coming out of challenges to the faith via evolutionary thinking, one of the names that Brad Wilcox mentioned last hour, Nietzsche, for example, some of those philosophies now for the first time had their own, quote, counterculture. Meaning that you would intellectually challenge Christianity or claim that it can't prove all of its claims. But when the time came for you to then say, well, then how do you think we should live instead? Up against the challenge of Christianity, these other worldviews would collapse because they offered no other alternative means of living than what we got from Christianity. Okay? And eventually, I've got to live in a world. I can't just live in a philosophy class. The counterculture emerges. And now we've got new sexual ethics, new identity ethics. And now there is, for the first time ever, a true alternative metric and means by which you are permitted to live and seeing some of your needs and desires as a human being met. So now Christianity has its first true competition. And what happened then is, once that counterculture reached a critical mass, it was an inverse of what happened in the previous era when Christianity was the subversive. Once that reached a critical mass where it was no longer cool, or you couldn't challenge that counterculture head on without some form of blowback, being called a racist, misogynist, xenophobic, homophobic bigot, the institutions and the culture then became neutral. And this would have largely been life in the 70s, 80s, 90s, well into the 2000s. It was neutral. We acknowledged Christianity. We were not hostile to it. We're not necessarily promoting it anymore. But we understand its influence. We give it the homage, and we understand that it represents a large block of the people that we either want to cater to or get votes from. But that's the neutral position in any culture is always a short stage, a temporary moment, setting the stage for what will be the new permanency. We are now in a post-Christian America in a negative environment. And now there is no more benefit of the doubt given for being a believer, no status granted to you for being one, nothing. No favorability. There's really no need to fake being one. You'll gain no advantage in the culture at all. All of the influences are negative towards being a Christ follower. All of the primary driving influences in the culture. And this is the first negative environment in American history. The exact environment that the book of Romans was written to a diverse body of believers, diverse by the definition of the time, who faced many of the same challenges living out this brand new worldview that we have today. Gentlemen, your thoughts.
Well, that was a tour de force right there, laying out this introduction. And I'll just say, personally, this book is important to me because, I mean, I don't know, Todd, is this a familiar thing in the Catholic teaching, that the Romans Road? That was how I came to saving faith in Jesus Christ back in 1999. The pastor at the church that I attended with my family at the time laid out during a celebration of the church's 45th anniversary the Romans Road. It's Romans 3:23, 6:23, 5:8, 10:9, 10:13, 8:1. There are different permutations and iterations of that, but 6-year-old Aaron, it clicked with him. The gospel finally clicked with him, or maybe for the first time clicked with him. And this book has the meekness and simplicity to convict a 6-year-old in rural southern Iowa in the year 1999, and the power to convict an entire culture and to empower an entire body of believers in the first century AD. I think that's why there are so many, or could be so many, disagreements about this, is because it's simple, but it's not easy. Hmm. What does that sound like? That sounds like the Christian walk. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the theme, I think, is going to be of this book, is that it's simple, but it's not easy. Being in this culture right now, what God has laid out for us, God's law, it's simple. Is it easy being that right now?
No.
Is it easy carrying that out right now? No, it's not. So that's, to me, that's probably going to be a theme that comes up over and over and over again. Simple enough to convict some snot-nosed 6-year-old in 1999 rural Iowa. Really, really hard to carry it out, the totality of it, back in the early part, the early years in which it was written, and now back in 2024.
Todd, you get the last word.
Roughly 5 years-ish before this letter came out, Emperor Claudius sent all of the cultural Jews into exile, and most of what was left behind were the Gentile Christians. And yet then the Jews do come back. Mm-hmm. You need to embrace that level of tension. What was going on there? How they were trying to reconcile it without the church as we know now, or the Bible as we know now? We had some of both, but Peter wouldn't come along until at the end, and then he was dead there. Even if you believe that he was the first pope, he wasn't there the whole time. We're going to have to try to put ourselves in their shoes, and that's not going to be easy.
It will not be. but hopefully it will be rewarding. One of the reasons why we are doing the study on Romans that we started today with kind of an introduction and a backdrop is the worldview data from our friends over at Nehemiah Institute. It's, shall we say, troubling. They've been doing this for 30 plus years, and they have this Pearce test. It's 70 test questions broken down into several different categories to kind of test your biblical worldview. So we're only giving this primarily to believers, right? There's no real point in giving a biblical worldview test to people that don't have a biblical worldview, just to see where you stand on things like politics, economics, education, religion, social issues, meaning the integration of your faith into your worldview and how you see the world and then live in it as while not being of it. And the results have precipitously declined. In fact, 90% of Christian youth score in the secular humanism category, less than 3% scoring in the biblical theism category. If you want to see where you stand, you want to see where your future next generation skull of mush, as Rush used to say, stands. It's just $17.76 per person to get a worldview checkup right now and take the test at worldviewcheckup.org. That's worldviewcheckup.org. Use the promo code SD101 to save 10%. So it's less than $20, and you can still save another 10% with the code SD101. Maybe if you're at a Christian school, maybe suggest it to the principal, the superintendent, have everybody, have the faculty take it, see where everybody stands. SD101, save 10% on this test right now from our friends at Nehemiah Institute. If you go to worldviewcheckup.org, that's worldviewcheckup.org. Speaking of worldview, can we actually prove the resurrection took place? My good buddy, Dr. Jeremiah Johnston, wrote a book called Body of Proof about this a year ago. Now he has a Bible study based on that book as well. And it's good to have you back on the show, my friend. How are you?
Steve, I couldn't be better. And I got to tell you, I am benefiting greatly as a dad of five children by your amazing Easter book. Is your audience aware you just came out with a new Easter book? I'm wondering.
Yeah, because they've heard about it a few times.
Well,
yeah.
I want them to
but
hear
but
it
now that
me.
We're to like the big event, I kind of feel, you know, tacky, you know, peddling my Easter book, you know, so I'm not bringing
tacky.
It up as much, you know.
Audrey and I have five kids, Abel, Ryder, Jax, Lily, and Justin. And Steve, I have an update for you. I always wanted to share this live on your show. We got your Easter book, which is part of this conglomeration of truth. Because in our home, talk about worldview, we talk about God like other people talk about their golf game. God is the constant factor, the constant conversation of our life. We got Why Easter, Jesus Died for Us So We Can Live Forever by Steve Dace. Thank you for sending it to me. We've been talking about the gospel. We've been talking about truth. I had an awesome day Monday, but I was exhausted. I'm at dinner. My wife made a healthy meal. I've been on a weight loss program, and I'm just sitting there chugging back the salmon, and Abel, Ryder, and Jackson at dinner say, "Dad, we want to become Christians." Now, they're nearly 8 years old, Steve. And I was like, oh, that's great. You know, praise God. Let's keep enjoying our meal. And then Justin, my ever-present 12-year-old theologian, said, well, you're not saved, Abel, Ryder, and Jackson. You have to accept Christ in your heart, and you have to be forgiven of your sins, like the Bible says. And Abel said, I believe that. I want to do that right now. Are you ready for this, Steve? On Monday night, November 24, 2024, right while we were enjoying our dinner, I led Abel, Ryder, and Jackson to faith in Jesus Christ. And they wrote it down in their Bibles, and then they immediately wanted to tell someone. So when I tell people to get your Easter book, we need help as parents. As parents, we need all the help we can get passing truth on to our children. So if you wrote the book just to send it to my home in Carrollton, Texas, thank you, Steve.
Well,
thank you so much, because now I get to baptize Abel, Ryder, and Jax, and part of their testimony was getting your book.
That means a lot, man. I appreciate it. I mean, that's why we wrote the book, and the reaction we have gotten has been pretty overwhelming. I've heard from a lot of grandparents, you know, whose adult children kind of have gone prodigal, And right. so they're using the book as a subversive means of getting this in front of their grandkids.
Yes.
You know, I've heard a lot of those
whatever
kinds of
takes.
Stories. Yeah. So, and
so, yeah, I believe the resurrection happened, Steve. And it's been a minute since I was on your show. I've learned a lot since I was on your show last, and I've saved my best stuff for you. And, you know, all you media, you want an answer in 30 seconds that takes me 20 years to learn. But I've actually brought some artifacts with me from Jerusalem.
Oh,
today
nice.
Is Maundy Thursday, Steve. And that, of course, in Latin means mandate in English. It's when Jesus said, "A new command I give you," according to John 13. And when I was in Israel to film Body of Proof, this is the Bible study version, which is different from the book. This just came out. And in the back of the Bible study is a code, and there's no extra charge. That code actually gives you access to the 11 episodes we filmed in Jerusalem. I was contacted by Lifeway Publishing. And Steve, just talking about the anemic worldview, I'm not surprised because Lifeway called me and they said, "Jeremiah, we've been in existence for over 100 years, but we've never done a Bible study on the resurrection of Jesus. We think it'd be a good idea to do a Bible study on the resurrection of Jesus, and we want you to write it." And so I said, "I'll do it as long as we can take a video crew to Jerusalem. I want to film at the 11 appearance sites of Jesus." Steve, we went there, and I know you know this because we're good friends, but for the benefit of your audience, we wrapped filming just days before the Hamas attack in Jerusalem. We had unprecedented access to film both at the Garden Tomb and inside the edicule of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The edicule is the little holy house inside the church that is believed to be the very spot where Jesus was raised from the dead. So while I'm there, I actually got my hands on a temple tax coin. And I'm holding this little silver coin, Steve. And I, for those watching or listening, please pull this up later on Blaze TV. This temple tax coin is the only currency that was accepted as the temple tax payment in the time of Jesus, both before and after. It weighs 14 grams. 30 pieces of this very piece of silver, Steve, is what Judas was paid on this very day, Thursday, to betray our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I'm holding it in my hand right now. This is also the currency, Steve. If you and I had to pay our temple tax in Jerusalem in the first century, the temple only accepted silver from Tyre, from the land of, you know, modern-day Lebanon. And so they would change the currency into this Tyrian silver. That's why Jesus is so angry. You know, you travel a lot, Steve. You've probably exchanged money places where you thought, "I think they just ripped me off with that exchange rate." It was far worse in the time of Jesus in the southern steps of the Temple Mount. So I brought that. I wanted to show it to your audience. I haven't showed it before, so I hope you enjoy that.
Wow. So let's pick it up from there. I asked you this once before. Let's do it again.
Okay.
You've got 1 minute. Global satellite TV to convince the world the resurrection of Jesus Christ occurred, because this is the most fundamental fact of Christianity. It's not a religion that begins on the premise of a creed or a doctrine or a philosophy, but whether or not this is a fact that God supernaturally intervened in human history to raise a dead Jewish carpenter named Yeshua of Nazareth back to life. If he did, then you start discussing and considering those dogmas and doctrines and philosophies that come out of that movement. But if not, then there's no point to the movement in and of itself. So this is the fundamental question of the Christian faith, and therefore really the fundamental question of all human existence, other than why am I here, is Jesus Lord or not? Did this happen or not? You've got 1 minute. The whole world has to watch. What is Dr. Jeremiah Johnston from the C.S. Lewis Society and Prestonwood Baptist and pastor of apologetics and author of Body of Proof? He's got 1 minute in front of 8 billion people. What does he say?
Like C.S. Lewis said, to preach Christianity is indeed to preach the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The Christian movement, unlike any other religion or ism in the world, is based on the historical fact that Jesus Christ was alive from the dead. He came back from the dead, a massacre on the Roman cross, which took place on April 3rd, AD 33. 2 days later, April 5th, he is back alive from the dead. He's physical. He's not spiritual. It's a physical body. And we know, number one, the resurrection is the only way we make sense of the suffering in the world, Romans 8:18. 18. Jesus predicted that he would die by Roman crucifixion and rise from the dead. Mark 8:31, Mark 9:31, Mark 10:33 and 34. Jesus proved they had power over resurrection in Luke 7, Mark 5, John chapter 11. Number four, all of the archaeology and all of the artifactual evidence that we have absolutely confirm the resurrection narratives embedded in the Gospels. And in other words, archaeology is Christianity's closest cousin when it comes to the actual resurrection. Number five, it's not what the disciples or Peter himself anticipated. No one expected their Messiah to die on the Roman cross. Number six, how do you explain the conversion of hostile witnesses? Jesus appeared to those who loved him. Jesus appeared to those who were indifferent to him. And make no mistake, Jesus appeared to those who were out and out hostile against them. None more than his brother James, who didn't believe in him. James 7, verse 5. None more than Saul of Tarsus, who has his experience on the road to Damascus. And finally, Steve, everywhere you go, and you see that the gospel of Jesus Christ is embraced and accepted, society is dramatically improved. It seems that the gospel and the gospel alone restores dignity, how humans were originally created to be.
That was about 2 minutes, but that's pretty darn good. Okay. And I got to tell you real quick for the audience, Rush Limbaugh's former producer, Bo Snerdly, put out a piece yesterday that I shared on all my social medias about some of the things you just touched on, but specific ways, the way all of human interactions were altered or changed fundamentally in terms of healthcare, economics, everything, because of the recognition that the resurrection took place. I've often, so I'd urge people to go get that on my social medias. It's really well done by Bo, and it's accessible. You don't have to be a scholar like Jeremiah to get this. You can just be a layman.
And by the way, I want to add this, and I want to just tell Steve, like in the words of Russell Crowe, Gladiator, are you not entertained? Is 2 minutes too long?
No, it's not. You did good. You did good.
Time.
That's why I didn't interrupt. I let it go. You were riffing. It was good. I haven't done this in a few years, but I used to on this show this time of year challenge people, show me what is the alternative explanation and narrative to these events.
That's a good way
that
to
stands
teach.
Up to any form of scrutiny. If we cannot empirically prove the resurrection, meaning we don't have Zapruder film, we weren't one of the eyewitnesses, okay? If we can't empirically prove it, then explain then what your alternative narrative is that explains why time, we changed how we keep time as human beings based on the truth of this event. Everything fundamentally changed on the claim of this event. So then what is your alternative narrative explanation that answers for all of that then?
Well, the best scholars in the world, I can answer this, like Garrett Ludeman, had to go to great lengths to come up with alternative explanations. I share this in the Black Book. I actually give the case against the resurrection. I spent 3 years of my life learning every argument there was against the resurrection, Steve. Garrett Ludeman, now dead, made famous the mass hallucination theory. It's like everybody got on LSD and all had the same bad dream that Jesus died by Roman crucifixion and was raised from the dead. I don't think Garrett believes that anymore. Ed Sanders, also not an evangelical Christian, the great E.P. Sanders, who didn't know what ultimate truth was, he said that there's no doubt about it that the historical record shows that the earliest followers of Jesus had experiences of seeing Jesus alive after he was dead. But he said, I'm not prepared to say what kind of experience that was. So even the critical scholars, Anthony Flew, by the way, said Jesus's resurrection, he said this before he died in 2010, he said Jesus's miracle, the miracle of Jesus' resurrection is the best attested miracle from all antiquity. Do you realize then what I'm saying? Garrett Ludeman, E.P. Sanders, Anthony Flew, these are not conservative Bible scholars, all agree that the tomb was empty in the best sources. When you talk about alternative explanations, the best sources point to the fact that Jesus physically, bodily rose from the grave. That's their best explanation. They're just not prepared to say what kind of experience that was.
Hmm. I've got 1 minute here. It seems as if maybe the best alternative explanation, and this is where the rubber meets the road with Christianity, this is why it typically doesn't play well with others in a culture, is you would have to come to the conclusion that all of these various influences happened through this Jewish carpenter because he was not heaven sent, but is an object or instrument of malfeasance instead. That this is a massive delusion. As he was accused of Beelzebub being able to cast out Beelzebub, you could not explain these things naturally. You'd have to explain them with an alternative supernatural explanation, and therefore accuse him of being from down below and not from above. And that's ultimately where the rubber meets the road, right? He's either a liar or a lord. There's nothing in between.
Right. And that's why I write in Body Approved, my new Bible study, Steve, if we wanted to invent a resurrection narrative that wasn't true, we would never have invented the Gospels the way the Gospels present the resurrection narrative. We would never make women the witnesses of the tomb. We would never have made the mode of salvation through a Roman cross, let alone a body coming back from the dead. We just wouldn't have made that up, because if the disciples were storytellers, they did a terrible job. The reason they really said that is because, guess what? It exhibits verisimilitude. It's actually what really happened. In real life.
Yeah, it's not really the most marketable message. Die to yourself.
No, it wasn't a winning proclamation. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, die to live, share burdens of other people, give everything you hold dear in this world away if you have to. That's not what Joel Osteen's preaching this Sunday, brother.
Right.
That's not the most marketable message.
But it is what Steve Dace is preaching in the kids' book. So before I sign off, get the kids' book, because I want to tell you, we need all the help we can get. I'm tired of all the diag books. I mean, I'm not, we need books like yours, Steve. So keep writing, Steve. We need your voice.
I appreciate it. Same to you, my friend. Good to see you guys. Have a great, blessed Easter, okay?
He is risen, brother.
Amen. He is risen indeed. Thank you, Dr. Jeremiah Johnston. Get Body of Proof. It's excellent. Gentlemen, we've got about 2 minutes. Closing thoughts. Todd, I'll start with you.
Well, I mean, the eyes to see and ears to hear. There are so many ways. I mean, you said it took 2 minutes. Steve, you wouldn't have even had to said a word. He could have taken the entire segment, or vice versa. Ultimately, there's just untold 2,000 years of history that testify to the truth. And we should not feel compelled at this time, in a time of so-called reason and science, that the people who tried to beat us over the head with that for so long, so easily abandoned in the name of nothing but emoting in raw paganism, and that was their intention all along, don't ever feel compelled to put your God into the science hole, the reason hole, exclusively, or anything like that, because somebody pressures to you. The proofs are there on multiple levels, and mostly in terms of relationship, because God is a God of relationship. Love has, in fact, conquered all in my life, in Steve's life, in Aaron's life. And if you want to look for it, you will find it. You need to ask yourself if you really want it or not.
Amen.
Yeah, just what he was saying in passing there about women being kind of the first witness, the primary witness of the nadir of the Christian faith, really get kind of at the, not the low point, but the very beginning stages. In that culture, the way they were regarded is not the same way women are regarded now. If it could have been snuffed out then, it would have been. So what's your explanation otherwise? It's 2,000 years later, still waiting for one.
Amen. We're going to stick around and do overtime for Blaze TV subscribers. For the rest of you, we'll see you tomorrow, noon to 2 Eastern after Glenn Beck. Until then, Romans 8:28.